From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday, January the 14th, 2020. And we enter the, I think it's the second week of the 2020 legislative session. We'll be back at the State House on Friday, broadcasting live from there to get caught up on what's going on in Montpelier. We got a lot going on here in the Waterbury studio this morning. We're going to be talking a little bit later this hour with Erin Bell. She is the chief distiller with a woman-owned business down in Windsor, which makes very fine beverages, spirituous beverages, in fact, and they have two items that are up for a possible international award. They've been nominated for something by the Good Food Foundation, which is an organization that honors both good food, delicious food, etc., and food which is made with a high degree of ethics in inputs and respect for agriculture and sustainable agriculture and all those sorts of good things. We'll be talking with Erin Bell in the second half hour of the program about that. Later on, it's going to be all politics. In the second hour, we're going to be talking around 10:05 with Lieutenant Governor Dave Zuckerman. He announced yesterday he is running for the top job this year. He's looking to, he'd have to win the Democratic nomination first off against Rebecca Holcomb and perhaps other entrants yet to be announced. T.J. Donovan has said the Attorney General has said he is considering entering the race for governor, and so it could be a pretty vigorous Democratic primary out there. And then, of course, Governor Phil Scott is the incumbent. He's in his second term in that office. He's a Republican. He is, indications are he'll be running again. He's doing some fundraising. He hasn't formally announced and said he wants to put off a formal announcement until after the legislative session. We had Colin Mine on from BT Digger yesterday, and he made an interesting remark, which was that Governor Scott probably would have announced by now if he were not running again, because he would want to give any other folks looking to run, especially on the Republican side, a chance to start campaigning. So that announcement hasn't been made, and so sort of by process of elimination, some of the sleuths in Vermont's press corps are figuring out, we think Governor Scott's running again. So. He would be up for a third term this year. David Zuckerman announced yesterday he wants to challenge the governor for that office, and we'll be talking with Dave Zuckerman in the 10:05 to 10:30-ish time frame this morning. And then later on, the capper on the show, the last half hour, we're going to be speaking with U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy about matters related to impeachment, and thought I'd warm us up on that topic this morning by bringing in one of our CBS News correspondents, Stephen Portnoy. He's on the line with us from Washington. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning to you, sir.
And I wanted to check in with you and just find out, today is expected to be some things are going to start moving on the impeachment front. Is that what we hear?
That's what we expect. In fact, just a short while, we expect lawmakers to emerge from a closed-door meeting that they're holding in the basement of the Capitol. This is the House Democratic Caucus, chaired, of course, by Speaker Pelosi, to discuss the precise next steps that Democrats are going to take. And we expect that they will announce that they have named the managers who would, once a resolution is adopted in the House, present articles of impeachment passed by the House to the Senate, initiating a trial. And those managers would be essentially the prosecutors in an impeachment trial. And what we also expect is that certain procedures will be initiated in the Senate, perhaps starting a week from today, for a trial that will last anywhere from 3 to maybe 5 weeks. The Senate is expected to sit as a court of impeachment for 6 days a week, 5 hours a day, with the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, presiding.
Wow, that, you know, one thing that occurs to me is that could interfere with the Iowa campaigning of people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. How's that going to play out?
There's no question that it would. And it's interesting because the Iowa caucuses are Monday, February 3rd. That's 3 weeks from yesterday. Mm-hmm. And not to mention the New Hampshire primary, which is 4 weeks from today.
Yeah.
And you've got, of the senators, I think it's now four because Cory Booker dropped out yesterday, four senators senators on the Democratic side. Was it three?
Amy Klobuchar, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. Is there someone else I'm missing?
You're putting me on the spot here. Probably, maybe it's only three.
Don't worry, I put myself on a spot too. So
right, you know what? It's a man named Michael Bennett, who you forgot is still running, but he's
yeah. Michael Bennett isn't there. Yep, okay.
Right. He's not going to be on the debate stage, but he's still in the running. So long story short, these are senators who will have to sit or will be expected to sit in session to hear the evidence as it's presented by both sides and perhaps even witness testimony. They won't be able to have, as we understand it, electronic devices inside the Senate. And this is going to be a very solemn occasion. The last time it was an impeachment trial against the president was held was in 1999. You remember it was against Bill Clinton and it lasted several weeks. And this is expected to take place with even more perhaps national attention because people will be able to follow it on their devices. The Senate impeachment trial of Bill Clinton took place in the winter of 1998 to 1999. And it was over before you knew it, it seemed. But this is going to be the focus of national attention, given the fact that, as you mentioned, it's in the heat of a presidential election campaign, and it's a sitting president who's facing re-election, who is actively arguing that this is a hoax. It should be dismissed. We don't expect that there are the votes for that. In fact, the White House doesn't expect it either. Increasingly, the White House believes there are at least four senators, maybe more, who are inclined to vote for a resolution to call for witness testimony. And that's significant because this whole discussion we've been having for the last several weeks has been about whether or not there will be testimony. And now it appears the White House is expecting that there will be because at least four moderate Republicans, some of them up for re-election next year, including Susan Collins of Maine, are signaling that they want to not give this short shrift, that they want to hear the evidence, hear the testimony, make a fair decision, even though it's all everyone expects that the president will ultimately be acquitted.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it is fascinating times we're living in here, and obviously the influence on the political situation is could be quite profound in terms of just the inability of a Bernie Sanders or an Amy Klobuchar any of the Democratic senators to get out there to Iowa and New Hampshire. That could hurt them in these early in the early caucus and primary there. Stephen, I wanted to check in with you also just to ask you whether there's any talk in the House at all. I mean, this was the case a week or two ago wherein some members of the House were saying they possibly could be crafting up other articles of impeachment to come down the road later. Is there still any talk of that, or is this going to be a one-shot thing, or I guess a double-barreled one-shot thing with two?
Well, I'll tell you, there's no Democrat who's going to foreclose the possibility that there won't be something else to present to the country or to the Senate ultimately. The question would then be, why bother going through it? Why put the country through it? And that'll be a political calculus that the House Democrats will have to make. But just yesterday we learned that Lev Parnas, who is under indictment, was an associate of Rudy Giuliani, is offering new evidence that he wants the House investigators to take a look at, having to do with some of these things. And so Democrats have talked about the idea that maybe they would pursue an article of impeachment about obstruction of justice, and that has to do with the Russia investigation.
The Mueller probe, yeah.
Exactly. And yep. So the idea that you've heard the last from House Democrats, I don't know. But they have suggested, and they've done it in court papers because of the legal aspects of all this, that it's possible that they might come back. Now, again, there's a political calculation to be weighed and whether it's worth it to go through it. But Democrats are saying, hey, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that a president can only be impeached once.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that would seem to be hanging out there, one would think, would be, Michael Cohen went to prison as a co-conspirator with Individual One in the Stormy Daniels, Karen McDougal stuff, the payoffs from campaign funds of these women. Any talk there of what about Michael Cohen's co-conspirator, Individual One?
That's an interesting point. I mean, prosecutors in New York have been trying to pursue information about the president's business records and House Democrats, too. And there is and tax filings. And there are a whole bunch of suggestions that have been made over the last 3 years that there might be something. Republicans would say, hey, You know, there have been, this president's been investigated more than any other, and they can't come up with anything, and this is all, in the president's words, a witch hunt. That said, the president has gone out of his way to not share with the American people the same kind of information that all of his modern predecessors have shared, and that's what leads to the suspicion that perhaps he's hiding something.
Yeah. All right. Well, sorry about the dropped connection there for a moment there. Stephen, I really appreciate you joining me this morning. Stephen Portnoy of CBS News. Let's talk again soon. The other thing I wanted to mention was we got into a discussion yesterday. Christopher Pearson was my guest, senator from Chittenden County, talking about the national popular vote movement. This is an interesting idea where folks who are a little worried about the electoral college occasionally diverting from the majority vote nationwide. This, of course, happened in 2000 when Al Gore got more votes than George W. Bush. George W. Bush was elected by the Electoral College following a disputed outcome in Florida. And folks got a little bit worried about the impact of the Electoral College and whether it really squares with the will of the majority of the American people, and or whether it diverts from that. I think in that case, just by the raw numbers, you could make an argument that the majority will was not reflected. And the this led to a discussion via email from a listener by the name of Ivan, who wrote in basically complaining about some of my remarks on this, where I was essentially expressing some understanding of why folks would want to perhaps figure out a way to reform the Electoral College. Now, the Electoral College, of course, is in our Constitution, and there is quite a long and drawn out and difficult process of amending the Constitution. If folks wanted formally to get rid of the Electoral College or something, they might have to go that route. Or because of the way it's set up, each state gets to decide it's the way its own electors are chosen. For instance, we were talking with Chris Pearson about this. Maine, our neighboring, not too far away state, just on the other side of New Hampshire over there, they have a situation where their electors are divided up by congressional district. So, for instance, in 2016, they had one of their electors go for Donald Trump and the other one go for Hillary Clinton by virtue of how the votes in the congressional districts broke down in the state of Maine. So states actually have Vermont's electors are, it's a winner-take-all situation where if you win Vermont, you get all three of Vermont's electoral votes. And most states, I think 48 states, actually have a winner-take-all system where all of your electoral votes go to the candidate who got the majority vote within that state. Well, folks who were trying to reform the Electoral College system without amending the U.S. Constitution are saying we should just set up a campaign to get states individually to vote to set up a new law saying that they're going to award their electors. Remember, each state gets to decide its own system for awarding its electors. Each state in this campaign is being asked to make a vote to say we're going to award our electors to whichever candidate gets the majority of the nationwide vote. So that would be an interesting setup where you would have a state, perhaps within the state's borders, the state might vote for candidate A, but if the law on the books in that state said we're going to support the winner of the national vote and candidate B got the national vote's majority, that's the way the state's electors would go. So there's an interesting possibility unfolding in the future, in future elections, if this national popular vote system wins. I tend to think that the best outcome, and it doesn't matter whether it's a Democrat or a Republican elected. I mean, some people are, I think this email writer yesterday, Ivan, was saying it's just because I'm a liberal or something that I didn't like the outcome in 2016. You remember that in 1980 and 84, when Ronald Reagan was elected president, and by the way, this writer was talking about a tyranny of the majority. In 1980 and 84, the majority vote squared with the outcome in the Electoral College quite well. And nobody was talking about a tyranny of the majority back then, that I recall. So I think sometimes people get a little bit over-politicized about this stuff and don't focus enough just on the mechanics and what are the best mechanics to operate an election with. I think there is a real question about, and I am fully in favor of trying to pull away to the extent possible that political bias. You happen to prefer one political party, and I was pressing Christopher Pearson, the senator from Chittenden County, yesterday. He is a progressive Democrat lawmaker here, and in the last two instances in which there was a difference between the majority vote and the Electoral College outcome, in both instances Republicans were elected, George W. Bush, and in 2016 it was Donald Trump, and the So I asked him, are you just worried about this because you didn't like the political outcome? And but I think he and his backers on this national popular vote actually do have an argument to make that ideally you want to have a system in which the majority of voters, nearly 3 million more voters vote for candidate A than candidate B in 2016, as happened in 2016, you would want to see the Electoral College kind of follow suit. It didn't happen in 2016. So it's sort of just a mechanical problem, which again could favor either party, so I'm curious to know what listeners think. You're welcome to chime in. 244-1777 is our call in number here in the WDEV studio in Waterbury. We have an interesting show coming up. The remainder of the show, we're going to be talking about spirits in the next half hour, and going to be bringing in Erin Bell. She is the distiller at Silo Distillery in Windsor, and she'll be talking to us about the fact that company is up for what sounds like a prestigious award for a couple of different products. Hey, we do have a caller on the line. Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Good morning, Rama.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, listen, with this, I'm glad he's talking about the Electoral College, but we have a much more immediate and at-home issue when it comes to our elections in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the gross discrepancy in representation in the State House, depending on what district you're in. Just as an example, and I know they're talking about breaking up the Chittenden district some, but right now, the Chittenden district gets every single voter, every single resident in the Chittenden Senate District in Vermont has six senators representing them down in the State House.
Yeah.
Every individual in Orange County has, in the Orange Senate District, I should say, it's not Orange County, in the Orange Senate District has one.
One. Yep.
And that's a huge problem. And the fact that, I've try to get people to pay attention to this in the State House. They blow it off quite frequently. I've even had their staff attorneys come up with cases supposedly obviating my argument that actually have nothing to do with what my argument is, saying that it's all okay the way they have it set up. And so I really wish these, people like Chris Pearson, I he's a nice guy, and I think his politics are half right, half wrong. But, we have this huge discrepancy in our in-state representation that really needs to get dealt with, because right now, especially Chittenden, the Chittenden Senate District is so overrepresented. It's ridiculous.
Well, it looks like there's a serious move on to try to break that up in heading into 22, so we'll see what develops there. Hey, Rama, thanks for the call. That's a good point to make there, and I appreciate it. We're going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. And as I mentioned, when we return, we're going to be talking about spirits. And stay with us, folks.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring. The aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air. The coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat. But we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
On into our second half hour on this Tuesday morning here, the January the 14th, 2020. And we have a lot of delicious products in Vermont related to, well, alcohol, I guess, is the magical ingredient in a lot of our great beers that are made in the state. And also, I think maybe 10 years behind a beer on the curve of development or whatever, but coming on hard is the terrific spirits made in the state of Vermont. We, of course, the Bar Hill Distillery just opened a big new building in Montpelier last year, and that seems to be a booming outfit there, and they make terrific stuff. And there's also a distillery called Silo Distillery in Windsor, Vermont, which is has been nominated by the Good Food Foundation for international awards in two of their beverages. And you know, I like to honor success stories in Vermont here, and that sounds like one that is coming right along here. And I'm really happy to say that we have with us in the studio this morning Erin Bell. She is the chief distiller at Silo Distillery, and she's going to tell us the story of that company. Erin Bell, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dave.
And thanks for making the trip up from Windsor. I gather that the roads were not a lot of fun this morning, and so really appreciate
Vermont.
It. Yeah, it's Vermont in the wintertime. This is what we get here, folks. Anyway, your story is pretty interesting. Silo has been around a little less than 10 years, right?
We're coming up on almost 7 now. So, you know, we started in 2012. Mm-hmm. 2013 is when we really got off the ground. Started as a vodka producer and dabbled in gins and bourbon and flavored vodka since then.
And it's your corn vodka, I understand, which is one of the products selected for this international competition by the Good Food Foundation, right?
It is. Our flagship vodka is made from 100% Vermont corn that we, you know, mill, distill, and bottle in-house, all in Windsor, and as well as our semi-dry cider.
And the so let's talk about. I want to talk about both products, but I guess we'll just start. We'll do it reverse alphabetically and start with V for vodka before we get to A for apple cider or even C for cider. And V for vodka. Why? What is it about vodka that makes that a good spirit for a startup distillery to you know, basically prove its chops or so on?
Well, there's a couple different things to answer your question. First of all, vodka is classified as a neutral spirit that's distilled at above 190 proof. And that's really no simple venture, having the right equipment and being able to actually distill a quality product at that high of a proof in the first place. It takes a little bit of practice and a little bit of cash flow. So we have a custom still from Germany. It's got it's almost a two-story column. It's 21 plates, and we're able to distill out really high-quality vodka in one full run using Vermont-grown corn. And from there, we add local water, which, luckily from Vermont, that's also really high-quality stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then because it's a vodka, it's not barrel-aged, so you're putting out a product that is ready to go to market right off the bat. You're not investing in inventory that's going to sit around. And as a craft producer, that's really great because you need to kind of get that revenue moving.
Yeah, you got to get the cash flow up and running quickly, I'm sure, so so you can keep the lights on and so on.
Yeah.
So walk us through I think a lot of folks out there, myself included, are not really that familiar with the distilling process. And you know, without sharing trade secrets or whatever that would give your competition a leg up, I'm just wondering if you can give us the basics, you know, distilling 101. You start out with corn. What happens?
All right. So the corn is grown and reaped in Vermont, and it's brought to us in 50-pound bags, which is helpful to us because we have to carry it up a ladder and dump it into our hammer mill. So we mill it in-house, and it's fed by an auger into a mash tun, which is basically, like I like to tell people, a giant KitchenAid. So it's got a big mixing blade in it, and we mix about 1,500 pounds of corn with water. And the water distilling is sort of a water hog. It produces a lot of condensation throughout the process, and most of that would go to waste. But we actually have in place a feature of our distillery where we actually collect that water, and we save it, and we're reusing it in cooking. So we're blending in that saved water with that milled corn, and because corn is a long grain starch, and you need sugar for yeast to cause the process of fermentation, we're going to break down those long grain starches into shorter, long chain starches into shorter chain sugars by adding a couple of different types of enzymes throughout the process, heating it up to really hot, letting it cook, and then cooling it down. And
how
then we'll
hot
pitch
do you have to
yeast.
Get it?
We take it up to about 80 degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty darn hot.
Yeah, and what sorts of fuel do you use?
So we use a propane-fed boiler, and we use steam to heat all of our cooking machines in the distillery. So for both our still and our mash tun, we use steam heat. Mm-hmm. It's easier to control. It's a better all-around use of heat in general because we can actually shorten the path from the boiler to the cooking implement, so it's a little bit more efficient. There's a lot of grain dust produced in the distillery, so you don't really want anything with like open flame or anything like that around it. So it's a nice feature to have, but it's also part of the reason that there's so much condensation throughout the distilling process. So after we pitch the yeast, then we move it into a fermenter and we let it sit for about 5 to 7 days, depending on the season. And that's where the yeast will do its thing. And when it's finally done doing its thing, we'll pump out that whole grain and water mixture into the still, and we'll do what's called a stripping run, which basically means we're going to strip the alcohol off of the grain mixture by running it through the still once and not running it through any of the columns. The boiling point of water of alcohol is lower than the boiling point of water, so as soon as you start boiling the mash, once it reaches the boiling point of alcohol, it's going to be flowing off, but it won't be pulling any of the H2O molecules with it.
I see.
So when it's done fermenting, it'll be 6% alcohol, but when it's done with the stripping run, it'll be around 34% alcohol.
What's the boiling point of alcohol?
I believe it starts at around somewhere between 60 and 70 degrees Celsius.
Okay. So that, and that's going to be somewhere probably in the, thinking Fahrenheit, in the 130, 140 range or something like that.
Probably. All of my equipment is from Germany, so
okay.
We do everything in Celsius.
Everything's in Celsius.
So
okay.
I will admit to being a little ignorant on the conversions off the top of my head.
That's all right. And tell me a little about your background. How did you come to distilling as a way to make a living or whatever?
Like most things in my life, I kind of accidentally tripped over it. I was actually out west, and I was thinking about going to get my master's in business management and start working for breweries because that was becoming popular, and who doesn't want to do that?
Yep.
And about the time I moved from Salt Lake to Colorado was when the Boulder floods happened. So my whole living situation was a wash, quite literally.
Okay, yeah.
And
uh-huh.
And about the same exact time, Peter Gilson, who is a good friend of the family, called me and said, "Hey, we decided to start a distillery. I could definitely use somebody with some business savvy. Do you mm-hmm. want to come back and, you know, start working with us?" And I said,
"Come back.
Let me think about
it." Are you originally from Vermont then?
I'm originally from Connecticut.
Okay.
And I went to school in upstate New York, and then my dad bought some property in Barnard after college, and I just moved straight there.
Yeah, I see. So you had been in Vermont, you went out west for a while, and then you were beckoned back by this idea of
I was drawn back by vodka.
By vodka, helping to run a distillery.
Yeah.
Why not? It's a good reason to travel cross-country, if you ask me.
That's why when I said I'll think about it, my friend I was staying with was like, "You will? Really? Really? Yeah. You're going to think about it?"
So back to Vermont, and you're working at Silo Distillery. Windsor is an interesting place. I got to say, it's one of my favorites in Vermont just because the so much history there. I mean, I love that Precision Museum, for instance, and I the whole feel of the downtown in Windsor, fascinating. How well does a distillery fit on the scene down there?
We kind of fit right in the perfect spot because we're down in Artisans Park, which is right off the highway, but we're basically across the parking lot from Harpoon Brewery. So the mm-hmm. whole place has been basically zoned for alcohol since Catamount was there. And we have the...
Zoned for alcohol. Wow, yeah, I've never heard that phrase before.
It's a thing because you can't produce just anything where you want to. So.
Yeah, right. Now, also, one of the hurdles, I understand, of getting a distillery up and running, even more than a brewery, is you have this thing called the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Yeah,
and
TTV.
I guess there's a world of regulation there that can make your head hurt.
Oh, yeah. There's lots of paperwork to push around. And then the taxation on top of it can make it very hard to do business as a small producer, especially when you actually put money into production equipment as well, as opposed to buying rectified spirits. So you got to get zoned for the proper placement. You have to apply for all the permitting. And then being Vermont as a control state, you also have to apply for all the permitting and licensing through that as well.
Yeah. So if you're talking about, oh, I want to start a business, and boy, I kind of like to sip on a nice glass of vodka now and then, or a glass of whiskey or whatever. Seems like a really cool thing to be a distiller. Maybe I'll go into the distillery business. We're talking about a pretty serious upfront investment, right?
Yeah. Probably around $600K.
Wow.
Just to really, just to get it started and then continued investment over the next few years to really get your feet under you, hire right staff, and expand your portfolio, and then hope people want to buy your product, too, on top of that.
Well, that's the hoped-for result of the whole thing, isn't it?
And it's a saturated industry, so it can be tough.
Yeah. And, I mean, that initial investment, you got to be brave. I mean, basically, you have to have a lot of spare change lying around and not worry about
Good friends.
Or some good friends or something. It's not for everybody, I guess is what I'm saying. So
Vermont's a good state for economic development, though, and we did get a lot of money through that as well. And they're good growing agriculturally based businesses, and because we source local, that's the way it goes.
Yeah, I mean, there's all this talk of the working landscape here, and gee whiz, there's some folks who actually seem to take it seriously. It's not just talk.
Yeah.
So that is that's got to be a good thing. So you actually even bounced around a little bit. I see someone asked you, how did you become a distiller? And you said you started in 2013 and then went off into still with the company, I guess, but doing more of the marketing and
yeah. When I started, it was more operational, administrative, marketing, sales kind of stuff. But you can't really market a brand that bases its entire identity on production if you have absolutely no idea how to produce stuff.
So in 2015, your first distiller left, and suddenly you were the one who had to carry the production torch.
Yes,
and
that was exciting.
So now I'm putting the corn in the in the machinery. And
I was doing it every once in a while to help out because we were running almost every day. But that was a shocking return from a birthday trip to Chicago to come back and be like, oh, hey, here you go.
You're
to the castle.
You're now chief distiller at the Silo Distillery. And that was 2015, and here we are, probably less than 5 years later now, 2020, and you are up for this Good Food Award. That's like, I don't know what the analogy would be, but somebody trying out basketball for the first time as a junior in high school and being in the NBA at the age of 20 or something. I mean, that's a fast trajectory, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, yes, but it's also, I think it's necessary when you're talking about small business growth, and especially in an industry that's as young as craft production. If you can kind of put experience under your belt any way you can, whether it's through talking to other people in the industry, reading a lot of books, reading a lot of forums, and just being lucky that nothing's blown up yet, then, I guess it is a pretty fast trajectory, but it's also necessary.
Yeah, once you're off the diving board, there's only one way to go, right?
You better go back to the surface.
Yeah, and I guess one other question I would have for you is a woman-owned distillery. Pardon the stereotypes that slosh around in my own brain, but I sort of would have thought this is one of those industries, and I picture breweries this way. Maybe you correct me on this, but somewhat still male-dominated or something. Is that the case, or are women pretty much on equal footing?
Yeah. I mean, Silo is owned by a couple, Peter and Emery. Emery runs the front of house space, but our entire production team is female, and 90% of our staff is female, though we have a couple of great guys in the field. But it's always been a male-dominated industry, and production in general, manufacturing in general, is a male-dominated industry, mm-hmm. but it's changing, and a lot of things like that are changing, and there's a lot of really great women on the craft spirit scene who are running their own distilleries and making their names even just as distillers. So it's really, really fun to see, and there's a lot of camaraderie in that. And it's exciting in beverages in general. Women are kind of like stepping into the spotlight. And we just have different palettes, different profiles, and different interests. So I think that's what lends itself to growth in a space that can be really hard to navigate is we have something new to offer.
I see we have a listener calling in, so let's go to Paul in Calais. Good morning, Paul.
Hey there. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit, those of us who have always thought of vodka as coming from potatoes, tell us about the corn, what you have to do, and maybe what it does on flavor. And I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer.
All right. Thanks for the call, Paul. Good question.
Yeah. And that's funny. Actually, vodka can be made from, because it's just a neutral grain spirit, it can be made from pretty much any source. And there's a lot of them out there. But doing it from corn lends a little bit of sort of a natural sweetness to it. Corn is also easier to break down as far as long grain starches go, as opposed to maybe a potato or rye or wheat. But it does, if you taste our vodka compared to maybe a potato or a wheat vodka, you'll definitely note that there is actually like a lingering, subtle sweetness, and that just comes from the nature of it being corn. But I think that to answer your other question, what we have to do to it, that might be a little bit different. I think we get away with being able to use less enzymes overall because the starches are easier to break down. And I think it also has a nice taste profile that's kind of representative of Vermont because we're so familiar with that product.
That is interesting. And I have heard of, I mean, obviously the traditional Russian vodkas and so on coming from potatoes, but I have heard of vodka coming from other grains aside from
grains, fruits,
other starches,
all sorts of weird stuff.
Pretty much anything you can get a starch out of, you can.
Basically anything you can get a sugar out of, and you have to distill it to over 190 proof, and mm-hmm. then it has to be filtered with carbon in some way to be called a vodka by the aforementioned TTB.
The TTB, once again, is the
the Tax and Trade Bureau, so it formerly known as the ATF.
So. Oh, a new name for this outfit that I was talking about earlier. Yes. Got it. Okay. Tax and Trade Bureau. Wow.
Yeah. They control all things having to do with alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. And we deal with them mostly through what we're making, formulas, and our label approvals, as well as all of our taxation.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the cider, because that is... And I don't know if it's wise in sort of real life to switch from vodka to cider in this maybe the same evening, but that might be.
I think you're headed in the right direction.
Oh,
there.
Really?
I mean,
okay.
You're kind of dropping the alcohol content. So.
Okay. Well, yeah. Okay.
You're easing off.
Yeah. Tapering down. The cider is. What's the process there? Is that a pretty standard thing, or do you guys do something special?
Well, yes to both those. So what makes the cider special is we source all of it from one single orchard, Moore's Orchard in Pomfret, Vermont. They pick all the apples. They've been in the orchard life for generations, and they've been making non-alcoholic cider for a long time, but we started taking it on and fermenting it and turning it into a hard semi-dry cider. And they're actually really great to work with. They select all the apples they're going to use in what they provide us, and they press them, and then we go and pick it up, and we ferment it at the distillery, and then we can it when we need to, so we don't actually overstore anything. And then what we buy during the harvest season is all that we have. So when we run out, we're out until the next fall harvest.
Yeah.
So it's a single harvest, single orchard cider. And it's called a semi-dry. We're kind of trying to take back that word. We add little to no sugar at all. We probably add about 6 grams of sugar for every 100 gallons.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really, really natural, light, and easy to drink. So it's definitely on the drier side of what you'd expect.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to kind of get people back to not needing overly sweetened cider.
Well, that is I'm sure, a noble goal, worthwhile.
Yeah, it's at least fun in the taste testing.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, there you go. And it's up for this international prize. Now, when do you hear about whether Good Food has selected you as not just a finalist, but a winner?
We are going to San Francisco this weekend. We find out Friday night.
Wow. So that's coming right up. And
yeah.
I wish you great luck with that. By the way, I will say I sampled... I recently sampled a bit of your gin, and found it to be quite delicious. There's another one. I don't know whether that could have been up for the prize, one of the prizes, but it certainly it tastes like a prize winner to me. So,
all right. Thanks,
yeah,
Dave.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Hey, Aaron Bell has been my guest. We're about to wrap up this segment here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. But Aaron made the long trip up here from Windsor this morning to talk to us about her business, Silo Distillery. You can find the bottles of their stuff on shelves in the state liquor stores around Vermont, and once again, recommended. Thanks very much for coming in, Aaron.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
All righty. We're going to do a break for some CBS News at the top of the hour. A couple words from our sponsors. Got a couple of good guests lined up in the second hour. We're going to be talking to David Zuckerman, candidate for governor. He's now the lieutenant governor. And, of course, in the final half hour of the program, U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy will be joining us on the phone from Washington. So stay with us, folks. More great radio to come.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store. We're funky, friendly, and almost world famous.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Heading into our second hour, and we're going to be welcoming, I think, shortly, David Zuckerman, the lieutenant governor of Vermont, announced yesterday he is running for governor of Vermont, and he promised us he would be here early for our 10:05 to 10:30 slot this morning, but I just got a message. He called and said that the Senate ran a little long this morning. Of course, the lieutenant governor's job is to preside over the Vermont Senate, so he was down in Montpelier presiding over the Senate session this morning. He thought it would just go a few minutes, and he'd be able to jump in the car and head over here to Waterbury to our studio, WDEV, but... He said the session ran a little long, so I'm expecting Dave Zuckerman to pop into our studio any minute here. So drive safely, Dave, if you're listening. We'd rather have you get here a few minutes late than slide off the road or something. So anyway, we also wanted to mention that he'll be running. He's just popping into the studio right now. And speaking of the devil, glad to welcome David Zuckerman, our lieutenant governor, gubernatorial candidate, into the WDEV studio here in Waterbury. Dave, thanks for coming in.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Excuse me while I take my jacket off.
Take your jacket off and sit down, catch your breath, and it's good to have you here.
Glad to be here.
I was just mentioning that you do face some competition here. Rebecca Holcomb, the former education secretary, announced last July that she is a candidate for governor on the Democratic side, and so there will be a Democratic primary, and possibly T.J. Donovan, the attorney general. He has talked about possibly entering the race for governor, so he is another person who may be in that mix. And of course, the winner of the Democratic primary would be expected to face off against the Republican governor, the incumbent Phil Scott. Phil Scott has been governor last two terms, and he is expected to seek re-election. He hasn't formally announced that, but we have seen reporting in vtdigger.org and elsewhere that he's begun fundraising. And the other big clue, I think maybe even a bigger clue on Governor Scott's intentions, is merely the fact that he has not announced he's not running, because if he were not running, an incumbent governor, one would think, would want to make that known so that others in his own political party could be gearing up their own candidacies for the job. And Governor Scott tells us he's likely to make a formal announcement after the legislative session in the spring. And that's really getting rather on the late side for anybody else to suddenly say, oh, he's not running? Well, gee, I'll get in there. So that's the way the thing is shaping up so far. And I wanted to ask Dave Zuckerman just to sort of tell us, first off, why are you running for governor?
Well, there's a number of things. I've been hearing from Vermonters all over the state for the last few years, a frustration that there isn't a little bit more work towards really building the foundation for our future. There's a lot of important words. The governor has spoken to many important issues facing Vermonters, affordability being a very key word, and I think he's right that it's a real challenge. But the facts aren't being fully presented. It's certainly frustrating, the expenses of living in Vermont, but the reality is northern New England, we're pretty much right in the average, along with upstate New York, New England. We have cold winters. Our on paper, our costs are pretty much average. Where we really struggle is our incomes. Vermonters' income is about 18% below the average, and that is how you get that affordability crunch, because if you've got the same expenses and you don't have the income, it's tough to pay your bills. But I have not really seen the leadership out of the administration on how to raise folks' income, whether it's the remote worker program, which you talked about in the State of the State address, that has brought in more than its cost. That was actually an initiative out of a couple of senators that he signed into law. When you look at the minimum wage, which if we could increase minimum wage by even just 50 cents an hour every year instead of 18 cents that it's doing automatically, every 50 cent raise is $1,000 a year in a working man's or woman's pocket. If we were to work our way towards a $15 minimum wage, we would actually be increasing the incomes of 80,000 Vermonters who right now are struggling to pay their bills, the majority of whom are women. We also have this climate crisis that is very real. We're feeling the effects of it annually. I notice it as a farmer. I think folks who recreate, folks who have born here and lived here for 50, 60 years, they recognize that some of the patterns of our weather are significantly changing. Our youth are crying out for the urgency of what's going on, and we have not really seen the investment and leadership from the administration on the climate crisis. He formed a climate panel, which was a very good thing to do back in his first year. They came up with 54 recommendations. Almost none of those have been implemented. Just whatever has been done in very, very small ways. And so there's a number of different challenges we're facing. We have oversight of our own situations in state government, as well as our senior facilities we've read about in the news. The governor talked about caring for our most vulnerable. I think he's well-intentioned in those remarks, but we've seen women in our facilities be violated, and some even to the point where they've eventually actually died. And then while they're out of prison, but with challenges that they faced, some of which occurred in their system. We've seen seniors in our senior facilities not quite get the management and care that they would like to see. I don't think that any of us want to see our seniors, who are certainly quite vulnerable in their waning years, be undercared for. So I think we have some real issues in the state, and without a little bolder leadership on how to tackle those challenges, we'll putter along, but we're not going to really build that vibrant future that Vermonters want.
And, you know, it's interesting to me, but I think back over the nearly four decades or three and a half decades I've been in Vermont, started here as a reporter with the Associated Press in 1985, and it seems as though we go through this cycle, almost like a long season situation, in which we have a period of activism followed by a period of a more custodial government. And so you saw the activism in Governor Shumlin trying to bring about, say, single-payer health care, which, of course, course, didn't end up working out. But that was his big piece, trying to get past the age of Vermont Yankee. Yeah, that did work out for reasons having probably more to do with the energy economy than anything else. But in the final analysis, Vermont Yankee did close. So that was a real period of activism in Vermont. And then we had a governor come in the person of Phil Scott, who said that he wanted to sort of slow it all down and get us back to maybe a less activist profile in our governor's office, and focus more on affordability and try to just quiet down some of the ambitions a little bit. Are we ready for another wave of activism now?
Well, I think there's a couple different brands of activism. Another idea that I talked about with the governor, I met with him 6 months in at my request and gave him ideas to say, let's work together and show that a Republican and a non-Republican can work together in this climate of Washington, where it appears the tribes can't even talk to each other. I said, why don't we look at the biggest drivers of cost in government, our public education system and our human services. And in our public education system, the big driver is the cost of some of the social services for some of our youth who are entering our schools, less prepared to be fully focused on the idea of learning. And I said, if we have two massive agencies and two massive budgets working with the same families, why don't we go down to the front lines, figure out how we can blend that service, reduce redundancy, and create a better continuum of service? It's not about more money. It's not about crazy activism. It's about just doing the job of managing government. And he actually never followed up. When I saw him a year later at a speech that he said, let's all work together, I said, I reached out to you. Let's work together. Let's make government more efficient. So activism can be in many ways. I think custodial care of government is a little bit lacking, because this kind of nitty-gritty work down with the workers in the state of Vermont to say, how can we do state government, schools, and et cetera, better and more efficiently, just as I do on my farm? Let's do that work. And let's work on some of these big issues like the climate crisis that we're clearly learning. We don't have time to dilly-dally and custodial sort of mentality with respect to our earth being literally on fire, as is true in Australia, and flooding, as we've seen throughout this country and included in Vermont. We've seen weather like, almost 60 degrees a couple days ago, and we're going to be down below zero on Friday. We're seeing these swings, and they're going to affect Vermont and our economy, and we need to do something about it.
We have a listener on the line. Larry from Rochester is calling in. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning. And one of the things that concerns me, you know, this minimum wage wanting to go up to $15 an hour, is a couple of things. Number one, it would be terribly inflationary, and plus it would put people in a much higher federal and state taxes. Those taxes are progressive. And when I think of, like myself, on Social Security, our raise this year was limited to 0.011%. I mean, it was embarrassing when I opened the note. And it,
that's
so
right.
Awful. And so if the $15 minimum wage caused severe inflation, which it most certainly will, seniors, especially that depend on Social Security for some of their livelihood, would be in tough shape. And I think of Jim Douglas constantly addressing the legislature in the past years about got to lower our cost of living in the state, mm-hmm. because our taxes are too high.
Well, thanks for the call, Larry. I think you raised some interesting points there. Tiny raise for Social Security recipients, Dave Zuckerman. You're talking
sure.
about percentage-wise, a much bigger one for minimum wage recipients. Tell us why is that justified?
Well, interesting. Relative to the phone call, the raise in Social Security is tied directly to inflation. So, if folks actually want, not that people want higher inflation, but the Social Security checks would actually go up more if there was a couple percent inflation as opposed to the 0.0001%.
Current system minimum wage would too, right?
Well, raising a minimum wage, that goes up based on some of these same factors. That's mm-hmm. why it only went up by, I think it was 20-odd cents, 26 cents this past year. But we have a combination that drives inflation. Wages, but also productivity. And what we have seen over time is productivity has gone up so that it's more efficient to make the products that we buy, so their prices stay down. But We have not seen a commensurate raise in the wages of workers who are struggling to pay their basic bills on things that aren't about widgets and things that we make. And so the wage increase can happen without necessarily driving the massive scale of inflation I think our caller was afraid of. And we're not talking about raising minimum wage to obscene levels. In 1968, the minimum wage equivalent today would have been over $22, $23. We're talking about raising it to $15 over 4 years, a rate that in my business, wages are about 40% of my business's payroll expenses, which means a 6% raise in the minimum wage of, say, 60 or 80 cents a year as opposed to the 26 would actually only raise the cost of products if we sold no more products by a little over 2%. The goal, of course, is as working people have more money in their pocket, they're actually going to buy more product. So the price wouldn't even have to go up as much as 2% because we would be selling more product with that productivity increases that we've been seeing. That's a little wonky, but the reality is if working people, if we want to have an economy that half of our people are living paycheck to paycheck and below the poverty level, then we should leave things as they are. But if we believe in a bigger middle class, then we should raise the minimum wage. And it's not going to really bump them into higher tax brackets because going from $24,000 a year in income or so to $25,000 or $26,000 a year in income is not going to bump them into higher tax brackets, especially under Vermont's more progressive income tax structure. The other thing is if you keep wages down and you say, let's not raise any taxes on the wealthy to pay for state government, then what happens is what we've seen under both the Douglas and the Scott and the Shumlin administrations, which is your fees go up, your car registration fee, your hunting licenses, your boating fees, your park registration fees. All of those are the way that government's now raising money instead of progressive taxation, and that hits working people far more than those who are wealthier.
Talk to us a little bit about the benefits cliff. That's another issue that especially applies to minimum wage workers and anybody really who's looking to move from, you know, $14 an hour to $17 an hour or whatever.
Well, that's right. There's clear evidence of that. You can go to my Lieutenant Governor website. There's a graph about the benefits cliff, which means as you earn more money, you receive fewer supports from government, whether it's for child care or for housing or for food or general assistance.
Healthcare also.
And healthcare as well. There's about 10 different types of programs that all nestle together to make sure our working people can live at least a somewhat dignified life, although it's still very difficult. And there has been a lot of work done, and I know the Committee on Economic Development under Senator Sirotkin's leadership is looking at how to make it so that as you earn more money and you then commensurately lose some benefits, the benefits cliff itself is when you lose more benefits in value than you gain in wages. And that means you're doing worse off by working more. We obviously need to remove that disincentive because there's a lot of people, I've heard many examples of individuals who went to their bosses and said, actually, don't give me more hours or don't give me an increase because I'll actually be worse off. That's just bad governance. And we need to find a way to remove that cliff so that whenever you make more money, you're better off, even if you've lost some of your support services. Because the goal would be to allow people to work their way out of state support and have us have fewer people needing state support.
Let's go to Ruth and Sheldon. Good morning, Ruth.
Yes, I think that small businesses are the backbone of Vermont's economy.
Definitely.
And you are burdening the small businesses with unreasonable laws like raising the minimum wage and paid family leave. And where your thinking is wrong is that most small businesses don't make $15 an hour themselves, the owners. So you're just putting these small businesses out of business. I've seen them collapse right and left. Now, the Brattleboro retreat, they said, is too big to fail. But when a small business fails, the state doesn't rush in to help their employees, to help the business to continue on. These small businesses are just collapsing all around us. I see Vermont is dying, and all of the, it's all because of the Democrats and the progressives in the legislature. What you are doing is not helping the people of Vermont.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate the sentiment.
Let's let Lieutenant Governor Zuckerman
that's okay.
Reply to that.
I appreciate the frustration. I think it's really important to put some of this into context, though, and the governor spoke about it in his State of the State address with respect to our rural areas. The reality is rural areas across the country, it doesn't matter whether it's blue or red states, high or low regulations, high or low taxes, those small businesses in rural areas are collapsing all across the country, and we're seeing a depopulation of our rural areas. When you don't have people in the rural areas, you don't have purchasing happening. Just like in my own neighborhood outside of Hinesburg in Moncton, there's a small general store, gas station, that's going to end up closing. When people always go to Costco and shop at the big stores or go to the big centers and shop at the big centers, that's what pulls some of the commerce out of our small stores and small businesses in our rural areas as well. And so it's really about population demographic realities. And since 2008, all across the country, since the recession, urban areas are growing. The exurban donut around them is doing reasonably well. And rural areas, like I said, it doesn't matter if it's Nebraska, Alabama, Wyoming, or Vermont, are all hollowing out. So we have to at least start with accurate facts and information and then work towards how do we build our populations in our rural areas to support those small businesses. And in fact, we have an advantage that those other states don't, because we are so close to the huge metropolitan areas to our south that if we can build our rural areas with a better broadband and start continue to expand our product sales to those southern areas, then I think we do have the opportunity for cost-effective growth in our small business sector.
Is there any new, a new tax structure, a new giant employer or industry that can be brought into Vermont? Or, I mean, is there any magic bullet that you have in mind, David Zuckerman, that could really make a big impact on Vermont's economy?
You know, I don't think that's really the crystal ball to go for is the big magic bullet. We were fortunate to land IBM many decades ago, but that was mostly because that person skied in Vermont and liked it up here. It had, you know, more to do with an affinity for the state than it did for any sort of tax incentives. Now, the times have changed, and now everything is about what corporations can get as much government money to be subsidized by to move somewhere. And you're actually seeing that in these, when Amazon did this competition and cities and states fell all over themselves to give them everything in order to get them there. But the reality is, even in, I think it was Wisconsin, I just saw one of the big touted tax giveaways by the Trump administration and the Wisconsin government was supposed to create 15,000 jobs, and now that company is actually saying they're going to create a lot fewer. Generally, I think it's far better to invest our resources in small supports for our small businesses so they can expand a couple employees here and a couple employees there and really keep those as family businesses where they know all their employees. They're going to care for them in the ways that we do when we know all of our employees rather than aiming for the silver bullet. We don't have the tax giveaway capacity that the big states do. If we try to win that game, we're going to lose badly.
What's your sense of the let's talk about some individual issues here. You've been a longtime advocate for cannabis legalization. Do you see, does Vermont need to move to a tax and regulate kind of a situation where you have shops people are going to go to?
Well, I've worked on, just to make sure people realize, a number of issues over the years. Worked on a lot of agricultural policy, including farm to school and farm to plate. I've worked on issues around, of course, we've talked about the minimum wage. We've talked about health care. It's not just cannabis.
Understood.
But the reality around cannabis is that it's already an existing economy all across the state. It's unregulated, so you never know what you're getting, what the strength of what you might be buying is if you're buying in the underground market. You don't know how it's been produced, whether there's been any herbicides or pesticides sprayed on it. And I think under a tax and regulate market, just like alcohol, you would know the percentage alcohol, you would know the percentage THC. We would have stores so that folks of certain age couldn't go in. And would that eliminate the underground market? Of course not. We don't want to promise everything. That's not true. But it would reduce the underground market, which would reduce some of the access for young people. And it would generate, I think, a very diversified rural economic boost by allowing for a lot of small production facilities all over the state where people could get paid a decent wage working on those facilities, growing legal regulated cannabis and then selling it in a legal and regulated way. It would happen, I believe, to boost our tourism industry. Would it have done more had we done it 5 years ago? Absolutely. But it's a safer way to go than just continuing to say, keep it illegal, keep going with the underground market, while states all around us and governments all around us are moving the other direction. I think it's time to move forward with a sane, small-scale tax and regulate system.
Do we run a risk if we legalize cannabis in the fashion you just described, and meanwhile our breweries and our distilleries are seen to be
they're doing great,
a bright light in Vermont industrial
sure.
development.
These they're the
days.
Model.
Are we going to end up essentially a state whose economy is over dependent on people catching a buzz?
Well, I think it's. People catch a buzz right now, whether it's a legal market or an illegal market. When alcohol was illegal, people caught the buzz, and now it's legal. And we have tourists coming, staying in bed and breakfasts, going on tour buses. Do we need to obviously talk about the challenges of substance abuse, substance disorders, and making sure to use any substance responsibly? We absolutely have to continue to have that conversation. But I think we can do both. We can celebrate good jobs and good businesses, as well as make sure we talk about how to do these things safely and responsibly for our families, our economy, and our communities.
Let's focus on climate change, because you're getting a lot of pushback on this, especially from our friends at places like the Ethan Allen Institute and so on. They don't like the Transportation and Climate Initiative. They don't like the Global Warming Solutions Act. Both of these things necessary?
Well, I don't know if they're both necessary, but the Global Warming Solutions Act, I think, is important because everyone wants to talk about how government and or politicians should be held accountable. A lot of politicians will say, we have these goals of this point or that point in the future of doing something, and then that goal comes and goes and nothing is done. The Climate Solutions Act says, no, these are statutory goals, and if you don't reach them, then the public can hold our state and our politicians accountable through the legal system, another branch of government. With respect to the TCI, the Climate Initiative, with respect to fuels, as I've said over and over and over again, unless I can support that so long as our rural folks who have to drive a long way to work because that's the only place they could find affordable housing, unless those folks get duly compensated for the added cost that it's going to bear them just to get to work as part of what you do with the revenue from it, then it doesn't really work out. Rural people, working class people shouldn't bear the burden of the climate crisis that's primarily financially benefited wealthier Vermonters and people in this country.
All right. Well, we are going to have to about leave it there because we are at the end of this segment. But David Zuckerman, Lieutenant Governor, candidate for governor, really appreciate you coming by this morning.
Well, thank you for having me. And sorry I was a little bit late. Tried to get here as quick and safely as I could.
That's quite all right. Thank you so much.
You bet.
We're going to go to bottom of the hour break with some CBS News. A couple words from our sponsors. We'll be back in a couple of minutes, folks. Stay with us.
The Warren Store is a warm and welcoming oasis during the winter. Our wood stove is roaring, the aromas of fresh-made soups and our daily specials fill the air, the coffee is hot and the pastries are fresh. Stop by for breakfast before you hit the slopes or make us your après-ski choice to relax and refuel after a day of fun on the mountain. And we have a great selection of grab-and-go meals if you can't stay and chat, but we hope that you can stick around. The Warren Store, we're funky, friendly, and almost world-famous.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back, and my final guest for this morning is U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy. Joins us on the phone from Washington, and I wanted to check in with Senator Leahy about impeachment, about the wide variety of other topics as well, if we have time. And Senator Leahy, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Dave, it's good to be with you. Thank you.
So it looks like the articles of impeachment are going to make their way to the Senate, possibly as early as this week. Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, we're being told they'll probably come over here tomorrow, mm-hmm. and they have to go through certain steps in the Senate. I think today or tomorrow morning they have to appoint managers and so forth, and they'll come over.
Mm-hmm.
and will receive them.
Yep. And now, do you expect that the Senate will end up calling witnesses to a trial? Or I know that Majority Leader McConnell has expressed some not really liking that idea. Where's this heading?
Well, McConnell has said that he doesn't think we need witnesses and so forth. But the fact is, we do. There are a lot of people that the Trump administration refused to allow to testify. People who have a great deal of immediate and personal knowledge of the attempts to get the Ukraine to involve itself in our elections, mm-hmm. which would be an impeachable offense. And they would not allow them to testify. I contrast that to the Clinton impeachment, where you had everybody that testified under oath for grand juries before the special prosecutor before the impeachment trial, including the President of the United States. Now, we know that Donald Trump said, of course, he wanted to testify, and then his lawyer said, no, you don't. And so you had nine key people who refused to testify following Trump's orders. So, yes, there will be a desire to have some witnesses that may come later on the trial. You may recall we did in the last impeachment trial, the witnesses who were called in to testify did so in depositions off the Senate floor. The Republicans asked Mike DeWine, former prosecutor, senator from Ohio, well-trusted to handle it for the Republicans. The Democrats asked me, again, a former prosecutor, to handle it for our side. Senator DeWine and I worked very closely together. There were no leaks what went on. Both Republicans and Democrats were satisfied with the way we did it. But we got a great deal of information.
And what are the key differences? Tell me if there are others that are obvious and that I'm just not thinking of them between the Clinton impeachment and the current proceedings to date. Anyway, Bill Clinton himself, President Clinton, came in and was deposed under oath, and of course that was one of the issues that led to his impeachment, is that he wasn't completely truthful in that deposition, if I recall correctly. President Trump, on the other hand, has not sat for a deposition throughout any of these proceedings.
No, in fact, President Trump started off by saying he would, and then immediately, once his lawyers talked to him and said, you don't want to go in under oath. Everybody knows here's a man who's told more falsehoods than any president in history. They do a running count of them in both the conservative and liberal press. And they didn't want him to testify. So that is a major difference. But the biggest thing was the nine key people who know the best whether a crime was convicted, he ordered them not to testify. And that has created, that's one huge difference. The other difference is that the Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, said he will consult and doesn't want to do anything that Donald Trump doesn't want him to do. He's going to consult closely with the White House. He'll take his orders from the White House. That is unprecedented. No leader of either party has ever done anything like that before.
Do you think that that disqualifies him, or some of the statements of, say, Lindsey Graham would disqualify in anything remotely similar to a jury trial? Wouldn't they be bounced out of voir dire?
If it was a trial, and I've tried an awful lot of cases, yeah, they would be gone on voir dire. Especially as you have to take a rather solemn oath to be impartial. And I've been there for four different impeachment trials, President Clinton's being the big one. Ironically, for a person named Nixon, not Richard Nixon, but a federal judge who, even when he went to prison, refused to resign from the federal judiciary because he wanted to keep on getting his lifetime salary. And we finally had to impeach him. But we had Republicans and Democrats who came in, worked together, listened to the facts, and got it done.
Yeah, I guess some cases might be easier than other, or the stakes not quite as high as for a president, for sure.
That one was pretty easy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess the other thing I need to ask you, just focusing still for a moment on the quite prejudicial statements. I mean, tell me if you think that's an inaccurate description, but I mean, From Mitch McConnell, total coordination with the White House is what he's offering, and from Lindsey Graham, all of his dismissive comments about the entire process of impeachment and so on, and a few others have been quite outspoken of just saying, and yet they're supposed to take an oath to say we're going to do impartial justice in the process of being jurors in this impeachment trial. Should they be impeached for violating their oaths?
Well, that's, of course, a senator cannot be impeached. They could be censored or removed from the Senate, and I don't see that as happening. But what it is, it totally ignores what the Senate is about and what the Senate should do. I've never seen anything. I'm now, because my seniority, I'm the dean of the Senate, and I've told both Republicans and Democrats, I have never seen anything like this before. I've never seen any senator, Democrat or Republican, so ignore what they are supposed to do as senators. And I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times and another one for the Rutland Herald, and I've talked about we ought to remember presidents come and go, senators come and go, but the U.S. Senate stays there. The U.S. Senate should be the conscience of the nation, and we're being anything but. It is disheartening to see people turning their back on what the Senate can be and should be.
Do you, speaking of the sort of longevity of situations here, I have wondered whether some of the instances of conduct of by this president, which have not so far been the topic for articles of impeachment, if they end up not being so, does that give a pass for the future? And I'm thinking here about the alleged campaign finance violations involved in the Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal matter. You know, Michael Cohen's in jail now. His co-conspirator, individual one, apparently, from what I can tell so far, won't face an article of impeachment related to this conspiracy.
No, that's a very good question, because those things, as was shown with Michael Cohen, that is criminal conduct. And I don't know if the prosecutors would have jurisdiction on will someday take steps in there or not. But I would have looked at that as an article that should have been considered for impeachment. It was not. We deal with what the House sends to us. The fact is, you have here the biggest issue, though in my mind, the issue is going to affect the United States the most, is are they going to take steps that will subvert, allow the subverting of our elections by a foreign power? We know beyond doubt that Russia worked very, very hard in the last presidential election to change the results of it. Now, what you do is have a president of the United States asking another country, in this case Ukraine, to involve themselves in our election. We have got to make sure that doesn't continue. We're supposed to have free elections. We're the oldest existing democracy. And if we're going to say we'll turn a blind eye to another country involving itself in our elections, then our democracy disappears.
A lot of those lines, I mean, in terms of stuff sort of uncovered by articles of impeachment, I wonder about the ten instances of obstruction of justice found in Volume 2 of the Mueller report. So far, they have not been resulted in an article of impeachment. Is that a signal to future presidents that that kind of conduct is okay?
I hope not. I hope that there will be follow-ups and prosecutions from that. So far, we've had an attorney general who has shown a disregard about the independence of the Department of Justice, but has made it very clear he wants to do whatever the President of the United States wants him to do. I think that is a bad mistake. And I think that what we saw in the Mueller report, there are cases in there where criminal charges could be brought. But remember, what we have here under the Constitution, we talk about high crimes and misdemeanors, actual crime. It means abusing a high office. There is no question calling on Ukraine to get involved in an election in a way to try to affect the outcome. That's abusing office.
Another area where I've wondered whether you could craft an article of impeachment about abuse of power. One type of abuse of power, which has gone on in a wide variety of realms in our world over many, many centuries, has been the exercise sometimes of raw physical power by men over women. And we have about 20 women who accuse President Trump of sexual misconduct up to and including rape. And I am wondering whether you could imagine, if the House wanted to, could they bring an article of impeachment saying, here's an abuse of power?
They probably could. I'd like to see criminal charges brought or civil charges brought. I think that would probably be the better way to do that. This kind of abuse of women has gone on far too long by so many people. We see the trial in two jurisdictions. There are charges brought in two jurisdictions, trial in one already of Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
And that was earlier, that was dismissed as a he said, she said, which of course was a way, we don't want to talk about it, we don't want to acknowledge it. Now they're actually paying attention to it, and I think that that trial is going to, it won't stop what happened before, but it may be a great deterrent of these things happening in the future. I hope it does.
I also wanted to ask you, the column I read over the weekend in the Times Argus and Rutland Herald that you wrote, Senator Patrick Leahy, you made a point in there that I thought was worth repeating here, and that is that an awful lot of the focus, and actually our conversation so far, you touched on the Ukraine situation. We haven't talked yet about obstructing Congress, and that when you started to say, I think in terms of the overall future of the United States, that this meddling in elections is a huge problem. But in the column, you seem to indicate that you were as worried, if not more so, about the second article and the content there having to do with obstructing Congress. And talk to us a little bit about that.
Those of us who actually, and I don't think the president's ever read a history book, but those who have, you go back to the time of the founding of our country, read what Hamilton, Madison, others said about the need to have three independent branches of government, judiciary, the executive, and the legislative. And that, they felt, was the best way to not have a dictatorship. Remember, this is a country, we became a country because we wanted a democracy, and we had not seen a democracy before. Having the checks and balances says that we will have a democracy. When you totally obstruct legitimate powers of Congress, the powers of the purse, taking money that we've given for example, to clean up the homes that our military dependents live in because of the mold and lead and so on, taking that money and putting it into a wall, basically a symbolic wall, along the Mexican border. If you can do these things and get away with it, then the whole checks and balance starts breaking down. But there's a whole lot of other things. When the Congress legitimately asks people to come and testify, a president orders them not to, without giving any reason not to. We're not trying to maintain classified information or anything else. That breaks down. And there are so many other examples of it. And then you see a further thing, and here the Senate's been complicit. The president is trying to nominate people to all our different federal courts, all the way up to the Supreme Court, who will rule the way he wants them to. Not as an independent judiciary, but the way he wants. They are picked by special interest groups, and I think what's going to come back to haunt us for decades to come is that Senator McConnell, instead of bringing up legislation, brings up these judges, passes them on a party line vote. They're going to be there long after McConnell's gone, long after all of us are gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I guess the other aspect of this obstruction of Congress issue is that, you know, we do hear from fans of the president that he is exercising executive privilege. And I wonder, how do you draw a boundary around executive privilege? What's the basis in your mind for that in the Constitution? And where is, you know, what's executive privilege? Can he just say, I don't want any of my people to come to Congress and testify?
I would ask the people who are saying that, he has a right of executive privilege, show me where that is in the Constitution. Show me where the founders talked about that. So long as you just simply let a president say that, what else can you do? Can you say, well, executive privilege, I'm going to war. Executive privilege, I'm going to confiscate your property. Executive privilege cannot cover up misconduct. There is nothing in our Constitution, nothing in our laws, nothing in the founding of this country that says you could break the law by declaring executive privilege.
So you mentioned executive privilege vis-a-vis going to war. Interesting that you mentioned that, because obviously in the last couple of weeks we've had an example of the president taking a rather warlike action in this attack that killed General Soleimani from Iran. And I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts about the War Powers Act and whether it should apply in situations like this, et cetera?
Well, nobody holds any brief for Soleimani. He was a terrible man. Nobody stands there as a fan of him. But the question is, why was this done? Are we going to start saying assassination of high government officials is okay? What kind of a precedent does that start when people, other countries, try to do that to us? And the disturbing part of this, the reason why the attack was ordered changes almost every time the president talks to the press or tweets or anything else. That worries me. I think that I think the War Powers Act do apply. We have gone into these endless wars for no reason. They're trying to use an authorization to get Osama bin Laden to continue wars throughout the Middle East. That's not right. And if you, again, the executive privilege, the acting as an imperial president, well, that did not work for Richard Nixon. It should not work for any president.
Let's bring in a listener, if you don't mind. Let's go to Don from Elmore. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Dave. Perhaps the senator needs to be reminded that the executive privilege was the way that Obama ruled in his last 4 years in office. I don't like it from any party, but let's not go blaming Mr. Trump for it when it really started with Obama in his last 4 years when he didn't get along with Congress.
So did Hillary Clinton come in and testify about Benghazi in front of the Congress?
I don't believe she did.
Oh, yes, she did. Oh, yes, she did.
Yeah, I think you better look that one up, Don.
All right,
For about 9 hours, she did.
That does not get us by the fact that Obama ruled with his last 4 years.
Okay, so if Hillary Clinton came in to testify, how about getting Mike Pompeo up there?
Yeah, I'd love to. The man wasn't qualified to be Secretary of State, but he's there.
Okay.
I'm not sure what executive privileges he's talking about from Obama's, because Obama had the Congress agreeing with him on some things, disagreeing with him on others, and if they disagreed with him, he certainly went along with that. You mentioned Hillary Clinton testifying for 9 hours on Benghazi.
Let's look at it the other way, Senator. We haven't had a president in the last 20 years that's been worth being there.
All right. Thanks for the call, Don. Appreciate it. Go ahead, Senator.
You know, if I could finish on that, Benghazi, the irony of Benghazi, the Republican leadership who had her in there had all voted against legislation to increase money for security of our embassies. I know, because I had put that in the legislation. I had gotten it passed in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
They refused to vote on it. So I thought, well, after all those hearings, I put it in again to increase the money. They're not going to be so shameless they'd vote against it again. They did. So the same Republicans who were saying, why didn't we do more for security, voted twice to cut money for the security.
That must have been a little bit galling to you, but...
it was, and I'm going to have to go and vote, too, in about 1 minute, so...
Okay. Well, Senator Patrick Leahy, I can let you go then. I know you're a busy man, and I really appreciate you giving us this much time on the Dave Graham Show here this morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
Dave, I appreciate it. I do listen to you when I'm home in Middlesex, I want you to know.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear it. And, you know, actually, we have just a couple of minutes left here, and I believe... Is Fred still on the line? No, Fred is Fred gave up on us. We were taking a little bit to get to him, and Senator Patrick Leahy. You know, I think this the contrast here is pretty remarkable, because very senior officials with the Obama administration, including then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, her testimony in front of the House Intelligence Committee about Benghazi was pretty striking, and she did sit there for 9 hours and take a lot of very hard questioning. And again, I just contrast that with the non-appearance so far by senior officials in the Trump administration, like Mike Pompeo, the current Secretary of State.
Exactly, and he won't testify. She did, but as I said, what galled me, the same people voted twice to cut out the money for increased security at our embassies, was saying, why, in effect, they're saying, well, why weren't you there, staying at the door with your AR-15 or something. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, what a world. What a world. Are we fast approaching the top of the hour here? I'm told by my good friend Dana Jewell here in the booth that we're going to have to go. But I thanks again, Senator. Really appreciate it.
And Happy New Year to you and all your listeners.
As well to you, sir. We're going to call it a day on the Dave Graham Show. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre and Common Sense Radio. And join us again tomorrow morning for another edition of our program. And it's always always good hanging out with you Vermonters out there, and we appreciate all the listeners' calls, etc. So have a great day, everybody. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.